Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Us, I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
What you're about to hear is not a typical Wheels Off episode, if there is such a thing. Joe Pug, my guest on this episode, is himself a host of a really cool podcast called The Working Songwriter. So this is something of a crossover episode in that once I finish interviewing Joe, he will turn the tables and do a little interviewing of yours truly. Joe is a singer-songwriter and, as I mentioned, a host of a killer podcast. He has written some really great songs. I've been lucky enough to see his career as it has grown from the very beginning. At the end of the whole thing, he, you know, sort of brings it all back to those earliest days of his performing career. And my having been around for it, which is very sweet. Joe is a sweet guy, and he and I, we're not the same generation. He's 14 years younger than me, but we're at different ends of a timeline in some ways. My kids are just finishing up their school years, and his kids are just starting theirs. You know, he's in more of the early stages of a career. And I'm in the middle stages. We won't say the late stages, but, this conversation, man, it went some places. And, there's a section towards the end of the Wheels Off portion, about 40 minutes in, where it gets pretty raw, honestly. I started to get choked up a little bit talking about, I think, my kids. And I probably started the ball rolling. And Joe then got a little choked up as well. And as it was going, you know, I think we both figured that we would have the editors chop out some of the time. After we finished the conversation, Joe let me know that we should just go ahead and leave it all in. So there's a section, you know, about 45 minutes into this. Just know it's going to get a little emotional. All right. So I'm really grateful that we went there. I think it's as real as anything has ever gotten in these Wheels Off conversations. And it's beautiful because of that. And I'm so grateful to Joe for being himself, you know, for being truly himself and for giving me and us, you know, a real honest glimpse into the humanity of his creative life, which is also his life. So, welcome to Wheels Off, Joe Pug. Welcome to Wheels Off, Joe Pug. It is so great to have you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Rhett, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
This is so cool. And for the edification of our listeners, from where are you joining us?
I'm joining you from a water-damaged basement in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is where I make my home and where I record everything that I do. This is my studio.
God, I'm so sorry about the water damage. How bad was it?
Oh, it was years ago. But
I thought it was Ida.
No, thank God. Thank God.
It looks great. Our podcast listeners won't be able to see it, but the room you're in has tons of cool stuff and books and musical instruments, and looks like you've settled in, made it a creative space.
I have. I think it's important to have a space, a physical space to create things in. I didn't have one for years, and I'm actually really surprised about the difference that it makes.
Well, this is so cool, man. So what are you working on right now, and how does it light you up?
Man, I do a couple things. I do, obviously, my main thing is I write music. I'm a songwriter first and foremost. I'm finishing up a record right now that is my most popular record continues to be the first one that I ever put out. I think that can be a familiar story for a lot of artists. But it was like a solo singer-songwriter type of album. And I've gone back and just completely blown it out and recorded it kind of full band, completely reimagined it. I'm going to call it Nation of Heat Revisited. It was the album that when I first met you, when I was first opening for you, the album that I was playing on many years ago. So I just finished that. That just went to mastering this week.
God, that's so exciting. Did you bring in a full band?
Well, in the COVID times, the way it worked is I virtually brought in a band. So everyone was bouncing me their parts. And I've gotten pretty nifty at audio editing at this point. So I kind of edited the arrangements into where they had to be. And then I sent it off for mix and master.
Golly, so have you always been so tech savvy? Because when I think of you, I think of like a troubadour with a piece of wood with strings strung on it and making noise with no plug in anything. But it seems like you've figured out the interface in the digital age.
I have, man. You know, about 6 or 7 years ago, I read a book called The Medium is the Message by
Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
And he, you know, just as the title might suggest, he really emphasizes in that book how important, he might even say that it's the prime part of importance, but how important the medium is for getting across your message as an artist. And so from there, I really started taking seriously the medium, the lens through which I would be creating music and the lens through which people would be consuming it. And so that made me start taking recording really seriously. So it started, you know, home recording, and now it's turned into something more serious. I produced my last record and mixed it. And this one I produced, I reached a point in the process where I realized I wouldn't be able to mix it. You know, mixing a full band is kind of a different thing, but yeah, I've invested a lot of time in the recording process.
That's so funny. I loved that book and was obsessed with it. And, there's so many things that it, sort of predicted, like the global village, right? But whenever I thought of the medium as the message, I thought the song, like the way that you're delivering something. I didn't think about like the literal physical delivery system by which you're handing them the thing. That's brilliant. Maybe I was just being lazy.
Well, I think there's several mediums there. I think the song would be one of them. People are going to experience a song a lot different than they experience an op-ed in the New York Times or, a lecture from their parents. But also, I think that you're looking at how it's recorded. That's another medium. And then beyond that, we can go even beyond that and say, you know, it used to be people were buying CDs at Tower Records and you would listen to an album in a certain way. And now the new model and medium is obviously streaming. So Spotify. People are consuming that in a different way. So I think artists, and rightfully so, are maybe augmenting how they make their works of art so that it can shine through both in the medium. Think about this. It goes even deeper, Rhett, like the medium of Spotify, but then also how important it is for your album to sound good on Apple earbuds going into people's ears. Like you have to, that has to be one of your references and mixed to that. So I think there's a lot of different mediums going on, and you always have to, as an artist, you should be cognizant of all those things.
It's so funny you say that. I find my teenagers a lot now will turn music on and just set down their phone. So it's the tiny speaker at the butt of an iPhone that's making all the sound.
You know, that's brutal. But I have to admit, when we have a party at our house, I do the same thing. I just turn it on. You know, sometimes I'll put it in a bowl so it's a little louder. But, you know, and so, you know, it's got to sound good in the mix. And you know what sounds damn good like that still? Recordings from the 50s and 60s. If you put on a Chuck Berry record just on your iPhone, just like that, it sounds great. Because they were used to mono. They were used to speakers that didn't sound great. So they had to record and mix in a very broad way, very not detailed way. And so his recordings still sound great when you're playing them through little iPhone speakers.
But I still think about those old recordings where they would just put one microphone and they'd all have to find the right distance. And then they'd have to get a take where nobody screws up the take.
Yep. Yeah, I know. I mean, wow. That's a totally different medium right there. That's going to change who is able to play on your record. Maybe you have to hire musicians then who maybe don't have as high of a ceiling virtuoso wise, but they can hit the take every time. And, you know, as we move on and recording becomes digital and more malleable, then you can have guys and gals who have higher ceilings of, you know, virtuosity, but who might screw up a bunch of times. I mean, the medium, this conversation just can go, there's so many layers to it. It's an onion, to be sure. Mm.
So when you were a little Joe starting out, do you remember, because obviously you've had, you know, some, you've had different chapters in your career. Like, it's funny listening to you talk about right now the prowess that you've developed with you didn't call it prowess, I'm calling it prowess with the technology that you use to make the music, the incredible work you've done in sort of, you know, the thing that I've been trying to do more recently with you know, interviews, conversations about creativity and the process, which is fascinating and noble, I think, you know, to just the troubadour work you've done. Do you remember when you were starting out, do you remember having a clear vision as a really young person about what you wanted to do? And was it music? Was there some epiphany? Did you have a vision of this?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think I've always wanted to just be in front of people and communicating with people. My grandfather, my dad's dad was the head of the theater department at the University of Maryland, and we grew up very close to there. He was an interesting guy. And he got me into performing a lot when I was a kid. And he directed one little theater troupe that I had when I was 6 or 7 years old. And he told me later that we rehearsed for months and months and months to do this little performance. And that as soon as I got in front of an audience, though, I basically just dropped the whole script and started, you know, pandering. to the audience. And, you know, that's always been, hopefully I pander a little bit less, but, that has always been, a sort of drug for me. That's always been a pull for me to go and kind of communicate with an audience. So in high school I did theater. And then, once I got to college, I rediscovered music, which I had played when I was a kid. And then in my 20s, things just kind of took off for me. And that's, here I am now continuing to play music, but I think it was always going to be some iteration of me communicating with people.
You studied like playwriting at some point, right?
I did. Yeah. I went to college at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill to study playwriting. It was a really cool program down there. The whole reason I chose it is because they kind of focused on students writing plays and then mounting them, fully mounting them. So I got to mount a few plays down there at North Carolina.
Wow. And were you already doing music, but were you already writing songs at that time? Were they competing for your heart, those media?
No, they weren't. But, you know, when I left college, problem with theater is it takes a lot of people to mount a production, and it takes a lot of money, and it takes a physical space. And as you know, I mean, with music, man, you just need a $75 guitar and you're good to go. You can write the songs in your room. There's always an open mic night to go to if you're not growing up in COVID times. Mm-hmm. Now there's always the opportunity to publish your music basically for free to the whole world. Not that anybody will listen to it, but it's still pretty cool that you can publish it, you know? So to me, I think the reason I ended up going the music route is it was just kind of like I love music, obviously, but it's also just a fact of it. It was completely accessible. I could start like today. You ever hear that thing? There's an anecdote about Richard Pryor. He was meeting with a new manager of his, and the manager sat him down for like 3 hours and explained this whole way over the next 5 years that they were going to take over the world and things were going to be great. And the manager stopped talking. And apparently Richard Pryor just said, "That sounds great. What are we going to do tomorrow?" And that's kind of the way I felt about music. It's like, well, I want to communicate with people. Theater, it's going to take a long time to do that. Music, I can start today. I can start tomorrow and kind of linearly move forward with it for better or for worse.
And it's funny. I have a 17-year-old son now who's super into Eckhart Tolle and the power of now, and like a pretty spiritual kid. And he's really reminding me of the thing that I think I used to think about a lot, which is what you're saying, right? Like the future is an idea that just floats out there, but really now is all we have. I love Richard Pryor.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So it's funny. Okay. So as you're talking about the necessity of other people, I'm reminded of the Sartre quote, you know, hell is l'enfer, c'est les autres. The hell is other people. Right. I've encountered that as well, right? It's so nice to be self-reliant. But I do know that you've, over the years, been able to collaborate with people pretty well. And that's just such a big part of music. And I wonder what your experience was, how you made peace with it, how you found like a way to work with other people where you didn't feel dependent on them or hindered by them.
Well, still not something that I'm great with, to be completely honest with you, man. Somewhere along the way, I don't know. It was probably when I became a parent 4 or 5 years ago, but somewhere along the way, I do feel like I got better at not having to be the person in a room when something creative is happening that is only pulling for my own ideas for the sole virtue that they are my own ideas. You know what I mean? And I think I've gotten better at tending to pull for ideas that kind of win the day of the marketplace of ideas of all the artists coming together. Not saying I do that all the time, but have definitely gotten better. And that, it happened to go with hand in hand with becoming a parent. So I suspect it had a little something to do with developing a better sense of humility.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which being a parent, as you know, Will, that'll come and smack you in the chops really quick.
Just wait until they're teenagers and they can roast you every day. Have you done a lot of like co-writing? Is that something that you've spent time doing?
I've tried. Last year during the pandemic, I tried to start doing it because I just thought to myself, I mean, for all the years that I've been in the music business, I never went down the route of, you know, a publishing deal or trying to get songs on film and television. So, you know, every songwriter at some point thinks to themselves, like, I should have a bunch of songs on TV, man, and just sit home and collect money. So I tried to start doing that a little bit last year. I'm not great. I had a really good collaborative process with an album I made a few years ago with Kenneth Pattingale from the Milk Carton Kids. He produced the album for me, and he co-wrote a bunch of the songs or helped me edit a bunch of the songs. That went well, though, simply because he was so excellent at that process, and I learned a lot from him. But 90% of the success of our collaboration there had to do with his deftness of working with other people.
Is that something you think that you have you done that much, or do you think you'll end up doing that producing?
I don't know. I don't know how you feel about this, man, but I'm in a place where I just don't feel like I have time to do that. Or maybe it's that I don't have interest, because when we have interest in things, we make time for it, right?
Yeah.
You know. And so up until now, I guess now that I'm responding to your question, it's making me be a little bit more honest with myself. Up until now, I've always said, well, I don't have time to take on other projects like that. But if I was really interested in bringing other people's music to life and it was something that I found invigorating creatively, I'd probably make time for it. So, I guess maybe the answer is no. I'm just interested in making records of my own to the degree that I can.
I talked to Harlan Coben, the mystery writer or thriller writer, and he described a famous mystery writer who was a single mother of 3 kids and had a full-time job. And she would wake up at 5 a.m. every day and write from 5 until 6:30, and then get the kids off to school, go to work, get the kids home, go to bed. And that was his thing. He's like, don't tell me you don't have time to write, you know? So I felt appropriately shamed
and also, no, man.
Also inspired. But that, yeah, I think that was his point too. If you want to do it, you'll do it. But I feel like I'm like you. It's hell is other people. I don't know that I want to produce somebody else. I have hard enough time producing my own world.
And I mean, it just takes so much time to make a great or even approaching great album. So to invest that time in someone else's work, you would have to have a completely different conception of yourself as an artist. You know what I mean? And I just don't know that I have that. Maybe when I get older, I will. I could see maybe, I don't know how you would feel about this, but I could see hitting a period of like, not exactly writer's block, but a place where I'm not writing as many songs, but still feeling like, well, I've developed all these skills. You know, the Liam Neeson from Taken. I have a certain set of skills that I can use on this project. So maybe if I wasn't producing my own songs at a clip, I'd feel inspired to go use those other skills on a record. But not yet. I'm still digging writing.
You've done so much. I mean, you've put so many hours now into talking to songwriters about their process and their work. It's funny, but you know, for someone that's not like actively seeking co-writes or seeking, you know, production, what is it that drives you to have those conversations?
Well, it started out of some pretty cynical reasons, and it's developed into something much, I won't say pure, but something much more edifying. I started a podcast 6 years ago because I noticed something that maybe a lot of other singer-songwriters have noticed, which is every time you put out an album, it's really hard to get other people to listen to it. There's a million albums coming out all the time. So I thought to myself, well, I'm kind of interested in doing this podcast where I talk to other people, and cynically, I could use it as my Trojan horse to get people to listen to my music. So that was kind of the reason. There was a good reason for doing it, but also I had some kind of brass tacks reasons for doing it. And it does remain that for me. It is on a brass tacks level very helpful for me to cultivate an audience by doing these conversations. But the edifying part of it that has really come out of it for me is we have a very small community of people that do this for a living, that are guys or gals who write songs, have cultivated an audience, and can make their living going out, communicating with that audience, trying to make beautiful things for that audience, and effectively, you know, give them to them in exchange for a way to pay your mortgage. So there's a very small group of us that did this. I remember at one time I went to go see Todd Snyder play a show. I was passing through Salt Lake City. He happened to be playing that night. I went to go see the show, and I was hanging on the bus with him afterwards. And he, out of nowhere, he said, "Joe, how many people you think are in this little club?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "How many people are in this little club where we get to just make stuff up? We make beautiful things for people who listen to us, and it, you know, it pays our bills." I said, "I don't know, Todd." And I thought that he was just kind of rhetorically making this flourish, but he wasn't at all. He started then trying to estimate. He was like, "Do you think it's 1,000 people? Do you think it's 750? Do you think it's 500? But the point of the matter was, whatever the number was, it wasn't a million, and it wasn't 100,000. It wasn't 50. It probably wasn't 10,000. So it's this very small group of people that do this type of work. And therefore, it should be a tight-knit community. But it never felt like that to me until I started doing the podcast, until I started reaching out to people. And I've found that people in our community are like just dying to talk about this type of stuff. They're dying to talk with one another. They're dying to have some sort of connection with one another that isn't just like shadow visiting someone else's page to see how many followers they have and then beating yourself up in the dark that you don't have that many or whatever. Like, you know, we want to root for each other. We want to exchange, you know, proprietary, you know, trade secrets to one another to help one another. And that's what it's turned into for me. And it's really cool. Now, when I go to a festival, in pre-COVID times, at least, when I go to a festival, or I'm around a lot of other songwriters, people just come up to me, even if they don't know me, they'll come up to me and they feel like they know me because this medium of podcasting is so intimate. And, I love that. I love people feeling like they know me. I love people just opening up conversations like that and just kind of getting to the chase. And I love kind of being, at the center of this very small community, whatever it is, like Todd said, whether it's 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 people, whatever. I love being in the mix with all those people.
And it's so you made me think of the old axiom that comparison is the thief of joy, which you know, shadow visiting someone's page and being envious of their follower number is the perfect example of these days. But it's sweet. It's almost like you've taken that and flipped it on its head. Like, we can come together and we can compare, but we're comparing notes and experiences, and we're learning from each other and helping each other.
Yes, yes. And so like, my two closest friends in music are BJ Barham of American Aquarium and Tim Showalter from Strand of Oaks. And those are always the conversations that we had together privately on the phone of just like, dude, how did you do this? I really screwed up this. I need some help here. Who's your supplier for this? I'm not selling any freaking tickets because in this market because of this. And it's really kind of open and vulnerable between us. I don't think it's that vulnerable on the podcast. That's a little bit more of a public forum, but it was trying to get to that sort of sort of friendship where it's a genuine friendship where people are rooting for the best part of the other person to come out, you know?
Yeah. Even though you're not bandmates, like, you're not part of the same crew that's selling the same exact item. But I love that you are really actively embodying the idea that the rising tide lifts all ships. That's great.
Yes. Or maybe even, you know, Tim or BJ in this case, maybe even them succeeding in some way doesn't lead to anything for me materially successful, or, you know, maybe there is no rising tide for me. And even then still willing the best for that other person simply because you love them, you love their family, you think it's a good thing, you love their music, so you think it's a good thing for their music to propagate as much as possible. That'd be a good thing for our community and for our country, for more people to listen to like those songs. So I'm not saying that I always feel that way, and maybe some of it is more cynical, and I am hoping for a rising tide to lift my ship too. But in my best moments, I'd like to think that this project is about really willing the best for my friends simply because I love them and I love their music. And I think that their music being more readily listened to would be a good thing for us, you know, as a people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a noble thing to give the world a gift like that.
Yeah. Or try to. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's funny. The idea of the rising tide lifting all boats made me think of a thing that comes up in these conversations a lot, which is the definition of success, right? Because when you say, I want to write a successful song, you could mean, I want to write a song that's going to make money, or you could mean, I want to write a song that reaches someone and touches their soul or whatever. And so that comes up a lot. And yeah, I guess when I think of the rising tide, like when I posited that, I was imagining that we're all trying to just make the world more beautiful. We're trying to give something to the world. So the tide that's rising is the happiness.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would be great if we all could make enough money to put our kids through college, right? That'd be great.
I don't know. My kids are young. I don't even know if college is going to exist as a thing by the time my kids get there. I hope it does. So I don't have to pay for it. But I think I see better now what you're saying. I think it says more about me that my mind immediately to economics. But yeah, like, that being the idea that the idea that beauty will save the world, right? There's a lot. If you scroll Twitter and political Twitter for long enough, there's a lot of things to be gloomy about in the world. And I, from an almost like spiritual standpoint, I genuinely believe that the world will be saved through beauty, that people will be attracted to what is sublimely beautiful and supremely beautiful, ultimately more than they will be attracted to the more destructive parts of our nature, which are, you know, fundamentally there. We're unable to get away from those things completely, but hopefully, as artists, we can make things that are so beautiful that it makes ourselves and the people around us want to choose the good rather than, frankly, the evil, you know?
I hope you're right. I think you're right. I wonder, the stuff that we're up against
externally as songwriters, as touring musicians, as artists, is pretty, I mean, that stuff's pretty obvious. And there's a million conversations that we can have about how to deal with that. And they're useful, obviously. But I wonder about the trickier stuff, maybe the internally generated obstacles, the stories that we tell ourselves to keep ourselves down. I wonder if, I'm assuming that you come up against them because I've never met an artist who doesn't, but I'm wondering what you've come up with in terms of strategies for pushing through those, overcoming those obstacles.
That's a fantastic question. Because obviously I have those strategies or I wouldn't still be here 15 years in. Like you said, every artist comes up against them. So there's nobody who's been doing this for a long time that doesn't have that. I was joking around, I think it was with BJ on the phone a little while ago, which I kind of have this policy of if someone's made it in music or creative work for over 10 years, even if I'm not like a huge fan of their music, they immediately go into the category for me of people that I respect a lot. Like, so even it could literally be, and I don't mean to beat up on Insane Clown Posse here. I mean, like, let's just say I'm not going to be turning on an ICP record or going to Gathering of the Juggalos anytime soon. And yet, I mean, the fact that those guys have made it 30 years in the music business, hey man, you know, there's something to that. And so, I think the reason that I feel that way is because of exactly what you're talking about there, which is we all have to come up with these strategies to get past these internal blockades. And if you can do that for over a decade, it's really impressive. So what are mine? You know, I think one of my main ones is keeping music as just part of my life. It's my job. I love my job. It will be when I die, hopefully many years from now, but it could be tomorrow when I die, music and what I've created will be a part of some small legacy that I leave behind. But much more important to me, and in fact, it's not even close, is my family. You know, my wife, my three kids, my parents, my sister. That is what is genuinely important to me. So when I get down to the dumps about music, as long as I'm, you know, still making some dough and I can still pay the mortgage and I'm not worried about how I'm going to pay the mortgage 6 months to a year from now, and I don't feel like there's anything catastrophically wrong with the business end of it, I don't really worry about it too much, man. Like I've let a lot of that go, and I can come up against failures, either external or internal, on a daily basis and leave those in the studio or leave those in the green room when I leave the show. And I sold, you know, half as many tickets as I hope to sell. You know, I can leave it behind because I have other things in my life. Not only do I have other things in my life, but the most important parts of my life reside elsewhere. So I'd say that's the main thing that keeps me going.
Is that an evolution that you can track? Like when you were younger, were you impatient and freaking out about everything more than you are now?
Living and dying by it. Absolutely. In my 20s, absolutely living and dying by every ticket presale count, every album sold, every person who we pitched a record to at a label that didn't like it, every press outlet that came back and said, it's not our thing. Like, yeah, I mean, living and dying by all of that. And not only was it a miserable existence, number one, but it also, that sort of worrying didn't increase my chances of succeeding with any of that stuff. Perhaps if it did, I would be fine going back and worrying about it all the time and making it more of a priority. But at a certain point, I realized, you know, the worrying makes you feel like you're doing something, but it's not. And it's probably hindering you too. You know,
that's what I've wondered. I've wondered if that kind of obsession, that kind of fear and fear-based worry, and I wonder if that gets in your way of being creative. And I wonder also if it becomes something that repels other people, like the scent of desperation coming off of you drives people away.
Not you, but us.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about there. And I think particularly that second point, I mean, how could we even deny that that's true? We all do that. Like, as human beings, we're instantly repulsed in social situations by people who, for lack of a better term, seem thirsty. I mean, we just are. I don't know what that is. And when I say, you know, seem thirsty, you know, normally 9 times out of 10, I'll be the guy that you could label with that term. But the 1 time out of 10 where I'm not that person and I see it coming from somebody else, like, I don't know what it is, man, but it's an unattractive quality. And maybe it shouldn't be an unattractive quality. Maybe we should strive better as people to deal with that and give credit to people like that. But I just know that how we work as human beings. I mean, if you look in your own heart, my wife calls it coming at somebody from an angle. Like, you can't come at them straight on. You got to come at them from an angle. And then if they don't want to buy what you're selling, just move on, you know? And we all know how unattractive it is when people come straight at you, not at an angle, and then they won't leave you alone.
You know? every single day I've got to sort of check myself, but it's that save me, love me, God. But I wonder, you know, something about what we do is built on that a little bit. Like, we need people to love us. We need people to buy what we're selling, is maybe what you just said. But I guess, how do you do that without, I guess you're walking a fine line, right?
You are. And then to get away from it, it's so hard to get things right in life. There's a million ways to do things wrong and like 3 ways to do things right. And so what I mean when I say that is, if you move away from that kind of thirsty mode, as I put it there, if you move away from that, one way to get away from that is to put these huge blockades around you. You know, these sort of defensive mechanisms where it's like, well, I don't care what anyone says about the new mixes or the new demo. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter to me. And it's like, well, yeah, it does matter to you. It does. And you can put up these defense mechanisms all you want, but that's not helping you either. So how do you get to that place where you are fine with people taking what you do and you're fine with people leaving what you do? It's, I don't know that that's a place that you can live in. I think that that's a place that you're always trying to calibrate yourself to.
God, that I'm going to put that on my board. There's a million ways to do things wrong and 3 ways to do things right. That's fantastic. T-shirt. I'm going to crochet that onto a throw pillow. all right. So in a second, I'm going to ask you to distill some of this wisdom for us. Before we get there, we'll take a short break to hear from our sponsors. And we're back. All right, Joe Pug, thank you so much. This has been so great. I love this. All right. So if you were to run into a 21-year-old version of yourself living and working in today's world, what advice might you give yourself?
This is going to sound so cliche, and it's not useful at all to anybody who's in that position right now. But I would just tell myself, enjoy it, man. Enjoy every single moment of this. I can remember, I think this happens to people a lot in their careers in music. When your career starts, a lot of things happen for you really fast, and you get this natural momentum that's at the start of your career because you're a new thing then. And people, you get lots of opportunities then. Then if you get a ticket to the dance after that and you get to continue on, you still get different opportunities, but they don't come as fast as they first did. So when I was on that initial little ride, I wasn't able to enjoy it at all because I was always thinking about the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And I also assumed that all these opportunities I was getting, I was like, cool, well, this is the first time I'm playing the Ryman. Cool. First time I'm playing Bonnaroo. First time I'm meeting, Steve Earle or somebody that I admire. And I just assumed that these would just be things that I would now do on like an annual basis or something like that. You know what I mean? Very, very presumptuous of me. And it really got in the way of me actually enjoying those experiences of just like, oh, wow, man, I'm playing the Ryman right now. This might, you know, this will be, maybe I should play this like this will be the first and last time that I ever play here and soak it in and really enjoy it. And my life doesn't start, you know, 10 years from now. This is my life right now. There's nothing guaranteed past this. So enjoy it, enjoy it, enjoy it would be the only thing I would have told myself at 21.
I love that. That speaks to me so hard today. That's really good. It's funny. I don't know if you do. You, are you aware, familiar with the idea of morning pages? Julia yes. Cameron's The Artist's Way. Mm-hmm. So great. So I was writing my morning pages this morning, and I was thinking about my kids going off to school, and in my son's case, it was his. I don't know if I can even say this without getting choked up. It was his last first day, and I was thinking about them, and I was writing about how fast it went, you know, the cliches, and I was just wondering if I could go back, what would I do again? And it would just be that, it would just be like, just really appreciate it, slow down those first days, that's the problem. My little kids are a lot of work and they're hard and they can be annoying, but man, when you hit the end, it's just whew.
Yeah,
you're like, I want to do that over again.
I know, man. I just did my first day with my son. He just started. I'm in that position that you're talking about. And I'll tell you, I've done a lot in the last year to really redefine my relationship with, frankly, alcohol. And
man, I'm glad you're talking about this. I'm 6 years sober myself, this is something people don't talk about. So thank you for at least even just addressing it. No, man, you're good. And man, being human is hard. I think you said that a minute ago, and I think it's so fucking true.
I've worked really hard in the last year to address my relationship with alcohol and different substances that I, you know, look, we were on the road, both of us, for a long time, all the time. And that stuff takes a bite out of you. And the reason that I'm bringing this up with talking about my son doing his first day and us trying to enjoy all these moments is, you know, it was the night before his first day and he wanted me to rock him before he went to sleep. He never asked for that anymore. And I got to really enjoy that moment. Whereas I'm not going to lie, like there's been some parts of parenting when I was in a different place where I'd be thinking, let me get these kids down so I can go crack a beer. You know what I mean? And you miss stuff when you're caught up in modes of that in your life. And I'm not even saying that I'm completely out of that mode of my life. I think I'm going to be back and forth with getting caught up with bad stuff. But the point is, being in a place in my life where I was actually able to enjoy that moment of before he goes off to his first day. I mean, that to me, that is, that was a spiritual experience to just be able to sit there for 15 minutes. How do we calibrate our lives so that we're in moments like that as much as possible? You know what I mean? And I think as an artist, that's what we're trying to do in our personal lives. And that's also what we're trying to do as we make our work.
That's beautiful. And that's a success. You were there in that moment. You were there.
Yeah.
God, we'll put on home movies sometimes on birthdays and stuff when my kids were the age your kids are now. And I was decidedly not sober. And there'll be a lot of times where the camera will cut to me and I'll be playing with one of the kids and I'll just wave her off, like, don't film me, because I knew that I was stoned or I was drunk. And here I'm like parenting and impaired, imparenting. Yeah. That's the new, my new word, imparenting.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with that one. Not the word, but the activity.
All we can do is just is do our best and be here. And I really feel like, you know, they say, You're living the examined life, and that's all you can do. Man, I'm really proud of you.
You know, it's funny with the, you know, you're saying, well, you call it jokingly imparenting because you're kind of impaired and you're watching kids. It, In certain ways, parenting is kind of like touring in that it's so much like hurry up and wait. And I think a lot of, for me, drinking and substance abuse or whatever it is, when I spent so much time on the road, it's something to do when you're on the road. It's culturally accepted. When you're watching super little kids that are under five, I mean, it's been a long day when you hit 5 o'clock, and it's kind of fun to crack a beer or two at five with dinner. And then when they go down, you go down at 8 or 9. You're like, well, I'm not hurting anybody. It's fine, right? But it seems to me like it's just such a tough dragon to keep tamed and in its place. And if it was just, you know, crack a beer or two at 5 o'clock, well, sure, no harm, no foul. But the way that stuff works is I don't think it tends to stay in the beer or two with dinner category at all. I think it tends to wander off pretty often, you know?
Yeah, not for me. And I think there are probably people who are really good at it. In our profession, I think it probably tends a little towards eventually it either goes all the way one way or all the way the other way.
Right. Yeah, that's what it does seem like. There's not too many, you know, kind of middle of the career rockers who are able to just have the one glass of red wine after the gig and then repair back to the hotel. It's either, completely sober, or we're looking for blow in Indianapolis at 2 o'clock in the morning, Monday, you know, so.
So normally this is where I would thank you so much for appearing on Wheels Off and for your openness and the wisdom you've shared and tell you how great I think you are. But
yes,
today there's more, because you're going to flip the script on me, I guess, right?
It is. So thanks for appearing now on the Working Songwriter podcast. We flipped it just like that. I wanted to talk, there's so many different eras of your career that I've wanted to talk about. The first one I think is kind of interesting. It has to do with specifically where you grew up. You grew up in the Dallas of the 1970s and 80s. And I think nowadays our national culture has become just that, like a more unified national culture because of the internet. But back then things were a bit more parochial, a bit more regional. So in my mind, you were still growing up in a city that was still very much haunted by like the Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm. still sort of not a one horse town, but a one industry town with energy and the boom of energy that happened in Texas in the mid 20th century. Can you kind of speak to the cultural milieu that you grew up in?
It's a really weird, specific cultural milieu. It was that I grew up with the vestiges of money, right? Like my grandfather was born into great wealth that his father made with a textile company. You know, his mother came from a long family of wealth. My mother was actually from Arkansas and they moved to Texas, but their family had been plantation owners, which is a less horrifying way of saying what they really were. Yeah. All of the money by the time I was born had pretty much disappeared, but we lived on the outskirts of the really wealthy part of town. So in the 70s, it's fun to remember Roger Staubach, you know, captaining the Cowboys to Super Bowl victories, but it was also, a kind of a dark time. My grandmother had stood on the sidewalk in downtown Dallas, one block before Kennedy was shot. She was obsessed with him. When she died, I found boxes of Kennedy memorabilia in her house, including right now in my office. I'm looking at an old jelly jar with a yellow rose and a note that said, "This yellow rose was from the table setting at the hotel banquet table where Kennedy was headed when he got shot." So wow. It's remarkably well preserved. But, you know, it was the city of hate. So nationally, we were the laughingstock because of JR. And we were sort of despised because there was probably some cabal of good old boys that had something to do with, you know, I say that I do think, for what it's worth, you didn't ask, but I do think Oswald acted alone. But whoever knows, right? There was definitely an atmosphere in the 50s, 60s, 70s, in well into the 80s, even in the 90s, and it may persist to this day. I moved away from Dallas in the late 90s. It was kind of a good place to be an artist, though, because I think you'll find that young people who want to make art, probably the two best scenarios are a place like Austin, where artists are revered and encouraged and subsidized, or Canada or something, or a place where artists are marginalized and downtrodden. And in a way, that's great because it's, you know, us against them. You know, it's this really underdog mentality. And so I came up in that, you know, it was dangerous. There was a lot of skinheads around, like racist skinheads. I got beat up as a, you know, 17-year-old long-haired folk singer by a racist skinhead. That was a big thing in Dallas in the punk rock scene and, you know, the rock and roll scene in the 80s. It was a weird place to grow up, and I like to go back and visit because I got family there still, and I do think there's really, really great things about it. Some great music still to this day coming out of Dallas. But yeah, man, it definitely informed some of the good things about my my work, but it also made it hard because I never felt like what I was doing was, you know, the right thing or good or cool. Like, it always felt like what I was doing was, there was a shamefulness to it, right? Like, I should be pursuing the almighty dollar. I should be in a fraternity. Instead I was, you know, this weird free floating artist, just believing I could improve the world one song at a time.
So what did that music scene look like for you? I know you spent a few years at college and then you came back to Texas to form a couple different groups, which one of which would eventually, of course, become Old 97s. What did that petri dish of music look like that was the counterculture in Dallas?
Boy, I did one semester at Sarah Lawrence College and had a full scholarship and bailed like an idiot. If my son did that now, I know. So Dallas at the time was all over the map, but I guess the late 80s, that's kind of how it was. You know, Edie and the New Bohemians were exploding, and I used to open for them every Tuesday at the 500 Cafe. Leroy Shakespeare and his Ship of Vibes were doing reggae. The Buck Pets had gotten signed to Island Records, and they were doing like some proto version of that 90s grunge scene. But one cool thing about this sort of schizophrenia of the music scene in Dallas, maybe everywhere, but certainly in Dallas at that time, was that I was a teen folky, you know, I was 16, 17, 18 years old with a 12-string guitar playing folk songs and, you know, trying to shake this British accent because I listened to a lot of David Bowie. But they would book me opening up for Lords of the New Church and Chris Isaac and Frank Black on a solo tour on a break from the Pixies. And like I remember opening for Red Cross at the punk rock club, the Theater Gallery, Red Cross being this LA punk rock, pop, power punk pop band that I was obsessed with. They still hold up. Their album Neurotica, I would recommend to anyone. But yeah, so that was a cool thing. It was acceptable to be different from the other artists on the bill.
And it seems to me like once Old 97s is born, it's really interesting because at the very start with you guys coming out of that scene, you kind of experienced music business, record business 1.0 for a while. You guys signed to Elektra, go on this wild ride. What did the business itself look like at that time, and how did it look different than things look now?
Oh my God, Joe, so our 14-year age difference, the thing you missed was the grossest thing about it. And because there was such an element of brass ring clutching, you know, there was a brass ring, there was a boardroom full of old white guys that would decide who was going to have the next giant record. You know, their lackeys, the A&R guys, would go sniff around in local scenes, and you would do anything to get near an A&R guy. The South by Southwests of the late 80s and early 90s were really gross. You know, I remember I had this crush on this one girl at South By, and she and I had gone on a date. We wound up in a Four Seasons hotel room smoking a big fat doobie with all these record label people. And I looked around and she had disappeared. And there was just some old I remember exactly who it was, though I'm not going to say it. Some old A&R guy, that former, like, you know, punk band member, A&R guy, and she had disappeared to his hotel room with him. I mean, the power that these gatekeepers had was so absolute. And so we all were desperate for their attention, for their love, for their validation, for their money. And it was gross. And when eventually the record industry collapsed entirely, and as it was collapsing, I was there for the ride. You know, we did have a few records with giant budgets. I made multiple records with $250,000 budgets. That's so stupid. But I remember thinking, like, well, yeah, duh, of course. This is not the way it should have ever been done. It should always have been some sort of a farm system with, you know, Sub Pops and Bloodshots, you know, right, building up artists developing their voice over years on the road, developing their audience over years on the road, eventually taking the step up if merit dictated. But it wasn't that. It was like, oh man, I got this, you know, this next thing that, and I'm going to look like a genius. And there was some element of meritocracy to it, but the randomness was probably 90% to the 10% meritocracy. It was gross. And I guess I was one of the winners of the lottery back then, but I never felt great about that element of it.
So you're basically saying that Rob Lowe as the A&R guy in Wayne's World was not too far off the mark.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. There were also good A&R guys. And it's funny, even in our experience with Elektra Records, like, we had 14 different record labels vying for the opportunity to sign us to their deal, which, of course, it's so funny to think that the brass ring was signing an incredibly lopsided contract, right?
Like some rapacious contract. Like, yeah, man.
But we at Elektra Records, we had two A&R guys that signed us, and one is still one of my very, very best friends in the world. And mm-hmm. one of them ended up having an EP of songs written about him by Britt Daniels, sort of excoriating him for his Rob Lowe-ness, as it were.
Now, what, you know, when you have an album that has a budget like that for it to be made of $250,000, and you have basically a large multinational corporation with an interest in not only recouping that budget, but making it into much, much more. How does that play out on, like, on the day-to-day level of how a record is, like, composed, recorded, made, the decisions go into it? Like, what did the process look like, and how is it different than making a record now for more indie labels, which you've been on with your own record label, which you are now the proprietor of? How did that manifest itself in the work?
So I'm sure everyone's experience is different. We got lucky in that one A&R guy that I'm still super close with, Tom DeSavia, is one of my best friends. And we still work on a lot of things together. Tom did a great job of acting as a buffer and also sort of working the label. There were enough people within the label that loved us and championed us. So our first record for Elektra, we didn't know anything except, oh my God, we have money. Look at all these rolls of physical, you know, tape that we're going to get to record on. We're filling them up, and I have all this time. Instead of 3 days, we have, like, you know, 3 weeks. And so we never thought, oh man, we need to sound like our label mates, Third Eye Blind.
Right.
The second record, there was suddenly an awareness. Now, we'd now done enough meetings in boardrooms, and we'd now seen the sort of disappointment on the faces of the different project managers and different people at the label, where they wanted Third Eye Blind. They, you know, for them to have a critically acclaimed, very low selling alt country act, at that point, all we were doing for the label was, we were somebody they could point to when they were signing bands and say, no, look, we're letting bands have careers. No, look, we're signing bands that are outside of the mainstream. Just look at these poor guys. You know, we didn't drop them. We could have dropped them. Anybody else would have dropped them, but we didn't. So, but we did use that to our advantage by, you know, and then also when we made our second record, it was a little more in my brain that we needed to try and make music that was less easy to pigeonhole. But But at the same time, I didn't feel like that was a gross move on my part, because I was frankly sick of being pigeonholed. You know, the alternative country and cow punk seemed incredibly reductive to me. So the idea of making music that was more reflective of the wide range of music that I actually listened to, be it Belle and Sebastian or Sebado or, you know, whatever, like those weren't my two like main bands. They're just two that popped to mind that represent a spectrum of music. So I wanted to do that as well. I wanted to make more interesting music that was less easy to categorize. What I didn't want to do was try and come up with an algorithm of music that would sell and then cater to that. So I never did that. And you know, maybe it would never have even worked because we were called old. Oh no.
We're back. I lost you at, you weren't trying to make an algorithm of music.
I was talking too fast.
No, you're fine.
I don't know that even would have worked because we already were saddled with the band name Old 97s, which is like the least marketable band name of all time. So yeah, you know, all it is just one foot in front of the next and try to figure out each, you know, one record after another. And I'm glad I never really came up with the algorithm because it would have felt gross. And even if we'd have had a hit, then what? Where would I be now? On a tour of bands reprising their 90s hit, a nostalgia act?
That's exactly, that is the answer to that question. That is where you would be right now. You know, you were talking about wanting to bring in all those different influences of yours that, you know, maybe weren't getting recognized at first with that band. It makes me think of one of my very favorite periods of your career is when you go out and you're going to make some of your first solo records, and where you land, it's so interesting. You land in Los Angeles with John Bryan to make, you definitely made the Instigator with him. Did you make more records with him, or was it just the Instigator?
He played a bunch on the following record, but didn't produce it. The George Strakoulias produced The Believer.
Right. So you end up, it's not like you stayed in Texas to make this type of stuff. To me, it's always seemed like you go and seek out, that was such a scene out there with John Bryan at that time. And was Largo going on at that point?
Oh yeah.
So like that, and it was like around Largo. I feel like there was a lot of kind of alternative comedians coalescing around that scene right there. So I guess what I'm interested in is, number one, how the hell did you end up in that that vortex? And number two, what was it like being there on the ground as an artist?
God, I got so lucky at that time to wind up in that scene because it was so nurturing. It really still is. Largo has moved to a bigger space and has evolved into a different thing. But it's still, the heart of it is still there. And it's this really nurturing community of now mostly comedians. At the time, it was a little more half and half, maybe even aired on the side of musicians. But it was, you know, like the elder statesmen like Colin Hay and Neil Finn. It was younger folks like Fiona Apple and Elliot Smith was a little older than me, but getting to sit on stage with him, sit next to him and just... to be like 1 foot away from him on a song swap after backstage, he and Fiona had both been, nobody's going to like us. We're so terrible. And I'm looking at them going, are you crazy? And it was so inspiring. The thing happens where you sit in the room with someone who's that brilliant and you think, oh my God, what am I doing? I can't keep up with this. But then that in itself is its own lesson. You have to learn to overcome that. What I'm doing is different from what they're doing. I could never do what they're doing as well as them, but I can do what I'm doing even better.
Right.
So it was really beautiful. And the comedians, watching the fearlessness with which, you know, Paul Tompkins or Karen Kilgariff or Mark Maron getting punched out by a guy in the front row, watching these people... night after night after night. And it would be like a comedian opening for me. You know, I would get, you know, Zach Galifianakis on stage before I would do my show. And Zach would be doing things that were so shocking and he would be making them up on the spot. And like that's super inspiring. And you know, you talk about what you do and what Todd Snyder does and what I do, and we all do it very differently, but it is, there's, a requisite bravery to the idea of walking out on a stage with no safety net. And sure, we have our songs, comedians, I guess they have their bits, but we're still walking out on stage and we could fly or we could flop on any given night. And it's terrifying. And that's part of what makes it so fun, I think, certainly for us, but I think also for the audience.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely either one of those things, being a comedian or a musician playing live. It is a very much what have you done for me lately type of experience. Even if you're like a known commodity and the audience loves you and you come out, they, you know, they know what you're up to. Like, you still have to deliver that night. You'll get about 5 minutes of people kind of nervous laughter and you know, giving you something. But if you don't give them anything, it turns dark real quick, man.
Yeah. Well, it's because we're asking them to empathize. And if what they end up having to empathize with is insecurity, like that's not great. That's hard.
No. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation for the Wheels Off interview, of like that idea of it's just very unattractive to have sort of that sort of thirstiness about you, even on stage. Maybe that's the worst place for it.
It's like the whiff of despair. Ugh.
That'll be the name of my autobiography.
The whiff of desperation.
How did your writing style must have been changed by going through that scene? Because, you know, you're in the scene that you grew up in, and now you go to a place where this scene is just filled with world-class artists of every discipline. Like, how did your own creative practice change at that point, being in that cultural moment?
Man, I think I had enough hubris to believe that I belonged, which thank God, because it would have been very really easy to just get shut down, instead of thinking, oh, they did that? Well, I could do this. You know, like I'm going to show up too. It's not a competition, but you always want to prove that you belong, right? Like,
yes.
And there's an element of hunger. Like I've always felt, and to this day, like literally this morning, I woke up thinking about the song I wanted to write and thinking that I needed it to be better than these other two songs I'd written, or better than someone else's songs. Like that feeling of being hungry has never gone away for me. And I hope it never does. I hope it never becomes something grosser or, again, you know, more desperate. But it's been really useful for me. So in those days, you know, I learned, I think it's about what you're rewarded for. So in the early days of the old 97s, we would go to little clubs and we'd be on bills with other bands that were what we now call Rootsy, but at the time had all these really stupid names, Honky Skronk or whatever. and the thing for which I was rewarded during those early days was, you know, how much can I tickle their corn pone fancy? You know, like I'm a seventh generation Texan, right? Like I feel like I have every right to get up on stage and do a little bit of yeehaw. But, you know, at a certain point, I just feel like I'm doing some dance that sure. That no longer feels appropriate. So when I moved out to LA, it was really nice to like feel the freedom of, oh my God, okay, I don't have to put on the overalls. Not that I ever technically literally wore overalls.
The metaphorical overalls.
Yes, I get to take off the metaphorical overalls and I get to you know, really do the broad range of things that interested me. And that was suddenly something that I was being rewarded for. Oh, you like pop music? You like, you know, like that power pop music that John Bryan loved so much? Well, he'll sit right next to you on stage and play piano while you just power through these power pop songs, and boom, that's like the greatest feeling you've ever experienced.
I feel like that is still a path that seems like a straight line between where you were then and where you are right now. I feel like that is a book that you're continuing to write here for the last couple decades. Do you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, the idea for a song I had, who knows if I'll finish it or not, but it was a song called Birds of New York. And it was, you know, it's this kind of rootsy sounding thing that hopefully will explode into like a big chorus that, you know, is not something that would have come out of Hank Williams Sr., but maybe the verse sounds like something that did. And maybe it's that marriage of the sacred and the profane, you know, the old timey and the 60s, you know, the mid-century modern. Like, that's something that's always appealed to me.
You, as much or more than most, I would be in this category with you too. As soon as the pandemic began, you leaned into live streaming big time. I know I did. I know Hayes Carl did. Todd Snyder. There's a fair amount of people who were kind of troubadours, for lack of a better word, who immediately didn't wait, just pivoted immediately to live streaming. So I guess my question is, like, what made you use that approach rather than another way to keep your business going? And also, how do you think it's going to change? How has it changed your artistic process or in how you connect with your listeners at this point?
I imagine that your experience was similar to mine, and tell me if it differed in any large way, but I think it's two things. What we do, songs and storytelling, is so built for this medium. Like, I'm sitting right now where I sit when I do my streams. It's where I sit when I write songs. Like, it's the difference between the genesis of a song and the dissemination of that song is not that giant. Like, okay, now I finished it. Now I can feed it into this HD camera here and this beautiful Apogee condenser microphone. And now they have it. So I'll only speak for myself. I felt very lucky that my product, whatever it is that I do, lends itself to this medium. Also, to the question of why so quickly and how did I land here? Terror, just sheer abject terror. I've got two teenagers. I don't have a savings account. What the hell am I going to do? So this is it. And what does the future hold for it? I've learned that I can do it. I've learned that I like it. And I think certain folks in the audience have learned that it works for them to attend a show like that, to come together in a community like that, whether it's the chat room or just the feeling of me and them together in a room. I don't think it's going to go away. I think there will be some portion of my career that is this, you know, that is live streaming probably for the rest of my life. And I think it's great. I get to put, like you're saying, I get to put my kids to bed. I get to wake up with them I'm almost always gone the first day of school, because summer, I take a lot of time off during the summer. Right. And then when September rolls around, I'm like, guys, I'm sorry, I can't stay home anymore. I got to go. And now I'm on the West Coast. Sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a real thing. I don't know how much you've been back. I've been back playing in real life shows a little bit this summer, and I feel a difference between audience members during shows and after shows with their level of familiarity with me, with their, they feel a real ownership of what's going on in a way that they didn't used to. They feel like closer to this. And I think it has to do 100% with the medium of, they feel like I've been giving them a fireside chat once a week for 60 weeks. You know what I mean? So it's, this is never going to be the only thing, but it's certainly, yeah, I don't see it going away. I talked to Hayes Carl on the phone a month ago, because he was wrapping his up, because he's heading back on the road a bunch. And he was like, man, he was like, Joe, you should quit it now, man. He was like, look, you don't want to be the last guy at the party. Hayes put it up. It's like, you know, Hayes, I've been the last guy at the party pretty drunk every time for my whole life. So why change it here? Before I let you go, I just got to let you know, I don't know that there's a question here. It's more just a statement of gratitude from me. But when I first opened for you 10 or 12 years ago, you were the first like national headlining artist that I ever got to open for. And I was still working a job, construction and stuff like that at the time. And then after that, I think you ended up maybe saying a word of encouragement to your agent or maybe your manager about me. And then I ended up on the road with Steve Earle after that. So basically what I'm just saying is, I feel like the trip that I'm on, I tell folks all the time, the trip that I'm on, it I can draw a line right back to you and how grateful I am for you. I mean, you really opening those shows and you putting in a good word for me, like, really changed my life, man. So,
oh my God, that's so sweet. I wouldn't have said it or done it if I didn't 100% believe that you have always been the real deal. But God, that's so beautiful, because it's funny. Like, you go through this, I won't say you go through this dumb life. My kids are telling me I need to stop saying things like that. You go through this beautiful, but too fast life, and it doesn't seem like it makes sense. And then every once in a while, you see how moments in your life from the past have ripple effects in your future. And you see how human beings can interact in ways that really wind up being like manifestations of love that reverberate over time and space. And I will never take any credit for what you've done, but I really think that I feel so proud of you and what you've done. And I'm really grateful to be able to just kind of share this community, however big it is, with you. And thank you.
This was a great talk, man. It's been an emotional couple of days, obviously. Thank you, man. I really needed this talk.
Oh, Joe, this is so great. This is what it's all about. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon, man.
Take care.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.